We're looking at how segregation and crime are connected in Milwaukee. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 3 years ago this week, the shooting of 23-year-old Sylville Smith sparked two nights of violent protests on Milwaukee's north side. And in the weeks after the shooting, PBS NewsHour asked some African-American men living in Milwaukee what it feels like to live in the city. Here is Milwaukee Alderman Khalif Rainey.
You're a threat. You know, regardless of where you have ascended to in society, you're a threat, you know, to many people in this community as a black man.
What questions do you have about the historical roots of segregation in Midwest cities? What do you think should be done about historical segregation? And how do you think police or other authorities should be addressing crime patterns in your own community? We're at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating crime patterns for an O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette University, and she joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So to understand how segregation influences crime patterns today, you stepped way back to the 1930s when Milwaukee was smaller and the federal government expressly used race to draw maps for housing lenders. So let's talk about these maps and how did they split up Milwaukee?
Sure. It wasn't just Milwaukee. This was something that was undertaken for all cities across the United States, really. And the idea was, okay, this agency put together by the federal government is going to go ahead and sort of rate different areas as to how stable of an investment they would be. But when you look back at these maps and you look at the notes, there are expressed racial biases within how they rank different communities. And so, you know, areas that they deemed unworthy of investment typically got a red shade, literally redlined. And it made it much harder for people living in those communities to get outside investment, to get lending, to purchase homes. And it's sort of helps create these patterns. And what's really interesting is how durable these patterns have remained, not just in Milwaukee, but in other cities. However, in Milwaukee, it is pretty sustained.
When you say durable, what do you mean by that?
It lasts over time. I think Robert Sampson, one of the experts I quoted in the piece and who also has done so much research on neighborhoods just across the country and specifically Midwest neighborhood or Midwest cities like Chicago and how those neighborhoods are segregated, says these patterns are sort of they're durable because they're not easily changed or broken. Once a pattern is sort of set, it sort of becomes self-reinforcing in a way. And then you have other ways, you know, once segregation is legally prohibited, then you have other ways of like zoning, transportation, access to other places that create barriers for people to move out of where they're currently living. And so it sort of continues to, again, be durable and have this really long-lasting effect.
So how did the maps affect homeownership among black and white residents? What do we know there?
So what experts here locally have told me and my colleagues, because I certainly am not the only person at the Journal Sentinel who has reported on segregation and these durable patterns, is that the gap that we see in black-white home ownership rates really can be traced to this idea of not being able to initially get loans and build that sort of generational wealth to have a property to pass down to your children or to have another form of basically a form of wealth. For many American families, that is buying a home is the way you start building wealth.
Right. It's American dream.
It is. It is. And so when you're blocked from doing that through, you know, either formal systems or informal systems, or it becomes you have a much higher barrier to accomplishing that dream, you are basically put on a little bit basically on a delayed pattern of acquiring that wealth. Right. So that's something that, again, people who I'll be honest, I'm not a sociologist, but people who study these kinds of patterns and also housing experts, that's what they say. Like these patterns that were created decades ago really continue to play a huge role in the homeownership gaps that we see today.
We're looking closer at these patterns, the role of segregation in crime patterns, with Ashley Luthern. She's with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she covers public safety, and she's been investigating violence for a year-long fellowship at Marquette. Do you see segregation affecting crime patterns in your own community? Are you a police officer or an attorney? Do some neighborhoods have less access to jobs and good schools or health care? And how does that play out in your where you are? Share your stories with us, 800-642-1234. Ashley, when did the federal government stop using these maps, and what was behind that decision?
I'll be honest. These lending patterns they were influenced to them. And, you know, as we know from, you know, Milwaukee just celebrated a huge anniversary with the fair housing marches and that sort of thing.
50 years.
50 years. So there was federal legislation passed that basically said, you know, you can't expressly have these laws to prohibit people from moving into areas like that. And so the federal government, it's my understanding, and I'll be honest, I don't know an exact date, but around that time, by that time they had already sort of around that time is when things started to shift, and it was pretty clear that this was deemed an illegal practice, right?
So we know Milwaukee is now considered one of the nation's most racially segregated cities. We know what segregation means, but how do you measure it?
So this was something where I learned a lot because I, like everyone else, have read all these other media reports, including reports in my own newsroom that talk about Milwaukee being the most segregated city. And the truth is, yes, Milwaukee is very segregated, and it certainly is among the most segregated cities. But when people say most segregated, they typically are referring to this ranking that the Brookings Institution puts out each year, where it's looking at a metropolitan area. But essentially, segregation, the most common way to measure it the most common way to measure it is by using something called the Black-White Dissimilarity Index. And that basically represents the percentage of Black residents who would need to relocate to be fully integrated with white residents. So it's on this indice or index that goes from 0 to 100. And 100 indicates complete segregation, and a value of 0 equals complete integration. And complete integration doesn't necessarily mean you have a 50-50 racially,
split.
Yeah, you don't have a 50-50 split. It's based off of your existing city or metropolitan area population. And so what you find is that the metropolitan area, which takes into account the surrounding counties, often really is ranked by that measure as the most segregated metropolitan area in the country. When you look at the city, there are other cities in the country that are that have higher Black-white segregation based off of that dissimilarity index. So Chicago, in our analysis, and my colleague Andrew Malika did wonderful work helping. Well, really, he took the lead on these dissimilarity indexes, and he was able to find, you know, Chicago, New York City, Miami, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Boston are all cities within their city limits that are more racially segregated than the city of Milwaukee.
So Milwaukee not being number one by any means, if you crunch the numbers in that way and using the census data.
Correct. So this was using census data, and for the country's 50 largest cities, I should add. And it doesn't mean that there's not a problem. It just means that, you know, I wanted to explain to readers what we're talking about when we say that it's the most segregated city or the most segregated metropolitan region, and how those are different. To some, it might be splitting hairs, but I think it's important to be accurate.
Ashley Luthern is our guide. She covers public safety for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating violence as part of a year-long fellowship. Do you see segregation affecting crime patterns in your community? Do you see neighborhoods that have less access to jobs, good schools, or health care? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Thank you. We're talking about the role of segregation in modern crime patterns. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Criminologists have long focused on individual choices and risk factors when studying crime, but more research is now looking closer at systemic factors like segregation. And earlier this year, a group of UW-Madison researchers, they launched a project examining the effects of redlining, where the federal government explicitly used race to steer away housing lenders. And here's Associate Professor Josh Garoon talking about the practice on Central Time.
And in terms of what the effects of this were, you have to look at who typically lived in these redlined areas. And effectively, if there is any significant population of African Americans, of black people living in these areas, they were redlined.
Has your family faced economic barriers due to segregation? Do you see segregation affecting your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran stays with us. She's been investigating the role of segregation in crime patterns for a Marquette University fellowship. Ashley, where is Milwaukee's African-American community concentrated today? In the same neighborhoods called hazardous by the federal government's housing maps?
Some, but as you noted earlier, these maps were drawn when the city was much smaller, and you've seen a lot of expansion. But I think yes, a lot of when you look at the patterns, I believe one of the pieces that I had and that I hope WPR will share had a map kind of showing where the current concentration of residents currently are by, you know, coded different, like with different markers showing the racial concentration. So you see a lot of the African-American population concentrated in the central city and then stretching up to the northwest. And then you see, white population along sort of the east side, and then also down near Bayview in the southwest side, you see a growing Hispanic Latino population in the near south side. But it's really striking when you look at these maps even today, you can almost see the barriers. I mean, I believe it was an exhibit out at the Milwaukee Art Museum a while ago that was exploring segregation and barriers, and people could post their own responses. And I saw one response that was just looked at Highway 43 as a real clear barrier, clear defining line even today. At least that's how this particular person saw it.
As we were talking earlier, we had been talking about the anniversary of Milwaukee's fair housing marches in the 60s. And we heard from Kirsten from Milwaukee, who shared this observation from her experiences as a social worker.
Milwaukee is so still segregated that when I look at an address, I can know what race that individual is basically going to be. If it turns out that they're not, I'm shocked, because it is that segregated in Milwaukee and still is. And it doesn't seem like anything has changed.
Doesn't seem like anything has changed. And Kirsten can literally tell from an address. What do you hear there?
What I hear is just echoes of, what people in Milwaukee have, they've shared every day. There is a sense of segregation, and that doesn't mean there aren't spaces where people are coming together, and some are very intentional. You have a lot of great work being done to bring diverse groups of people together and be really inclusive and lift other voices when it comes to matters of public policy. But in terms of spaces where we live, where we work, where we play, those can still be pretty segregated areas. What I found really interesting, Robert Sampson, the researcher I mentioned earlier, who's out of Harvard, he has a brand new study with his colleagues where they actually looked at something they called equitable mobility. So not only how residentially segregated is an area, but how much are people going to places where going to different neighborhoods. And they actually used Twitter to do this. They analyzed 650 million geotag tweets, and they estimated how evenly residents of each neighborhood in the 50 largest American cities visited other neighborhoods. And so Milwaukee actually, in this brand new research, ranked low compared to the other places. So 75% of the other cities had this higher equitable mobility, meaning their residents were visiting neighborhoods more equally. And so his point to that was, of course, it is a large swath of data, huge millions upon millions of tweets. But he says, it suggests that not only are we racially, residentially segregated, but we also are segregated in many other ways. And that also has impacts for how we even talk about public policy solutions or how we even try to solve problems like segregation.
We're talking with Ashley Lutheran. She writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're looking at the role of segregation in Milwaukee over time. You can join in with reflections on your own community at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Owen now, joining us from Waiawiga. Hi, Owen. Hey, hi, Owen.
Hi. Good morning. I guess what always astonished me about Milwaukee was the fact that people always had access to intoxicants like drugs and, you know, heroin and harder drugs, things like that, down there really readily available. And then things like good nutritious foods and stuff in their neighborhoods were harder to acquire or harder to get to because of the lack of transportation. And they also had lack of the ability to get to good employment because of the transportation deficit they have there. And then on top of that, the people that are trafficking drugs up into the rural areas, like where I live, they always write up in these articles saying how the sheriff's department and the law enforcement watch them go to Milwaukee and come back several times. So it's almost like they're using Milwaukee as a way to, perpetuate this law enforcement motivation to find and apprehend drug traffickers. So,
Owen, thank you. And help us, Ashley, connect the dots here, because Owen brings up food deserts. He brings up drug problems that spread to rural areas. Where does this all tie in with segregation and crime?
Well, I think Owen's point about food deserts and the lack of transit options, the lack of employment, family-supporting jobs in segregated neighborhoods, those are all really important contexts to keep in mind for the context of crime, right? So it's not a surprise to anyone, I would argue, that when you have areas that have been heavily disinvested and they don't have access to, the resources that other neighborhoods might have, that there might be some sort of, basically, you know, someone has, I forget who told me this, but, you know, basically another economy springs up, whether that's in drugs or something else. And I think the patterns, when you overlay all these sort of what we would call, or what many people would call, like root causes of crime, right? Like poverty or, low educational attainment. When you overlay those, they all sort of match up to these historic redlined areas. So to me, that just shows, again, that durability of continuous disinvestment. And he also brings up transit. I think if you talk to the Fair Housing Council, you'll hear a lot about how important transit or access to jobs and other places can be really important in breaking down segregation, as well as, you know, combating informal combating discrimination, which now is, you know, considered more of like soft discrimination. It can be harder to prove in court that someone was discriminated against if they go to rent somewhere else. So that's all work that the Fair Housing Council is tackling, and those are all ways to try to make Milwaukee a more integrated community.
Let's bring in Andrea now in Sauk County with thoughts on this. Hi, Andrea.
Yeah, hi, good morning. So my understanding is that during the Great Migration, you know, the 20s through the, you know, early 70s, there were a lot of neighborhoods that African Americans were explicitly not allowed to buy into. You know, so there might be, I know Chicago seemed to be like really egregious, but, you know, there would be, you know, these specific areas, and you can even buy a block over. So it's, you know, on all of us as well, sort of these historical segregation norms became normalized.
Andrea, thanks. What do we know about immigration patterns, Ashley, and how a city was organized in a way?
I think Andrea brings up great points, and my colleague, particularly John Schmidt, has written a lot about this for quite a while. During that period of Great Migration, African Americans in Milwaukee were able, just like others who came to the city, were able to get really great family-supporting jobs in manufacturing and in industry. The Great Migration came a little bit later to Milwaukee than other cities like Chicago. And as part of that, you know, you hear stories and research has sort of borne this out that African Americans who are working these jobs often got some of the most difficult jobs in the factories. They may have been discriminated against when it came to labor unions. I know in other places, I will be honest, I haven't looked particularly deep at Milwaukee in that aspect. But that's something that you hear and see across the country. And then they were sort of the, you know, last hired, first let go, first fired sort of thing. So as manufacturing began to decline and those jobs began to erode, they were here. African-Americans had been here sort of from the Great Migration, at least a shorter period of time, again, had built up a little bit less of that generational wealth. And yes, as Andrea pointed out, and a lot of times they were, you know, steered or explicitly told you can't buy a home in this particular area. Some homes have had deed restrictions, covenants attached to them. In which the property explicitly said, like, this property cannot be sold to anyone other than a white person.
We're talking about redlining, where banks choke off lending to people of color, how this impacts segregation in Milwaukee over time, and finally, that connection to crime patterns. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Lutheran has been investigating this as part of a fellowship. You can join in. How do you think police or authorities should be addressing crime patterns in your community? What do you think can be done about historical segregation? We're spending the hour on this. Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what segregation in Milwaukee means and how it relates to crime patterns. You're with us for an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee isn't unique. Straight across the country, the cities with the greatest geographic segregation, they tend to have the highest rates of violence. So among cities with over 250,000 people, the FBI says St. Louis, Detroit, and Baltimore have the highest violent crime rate. Milwaukee is among the top 10, and that's data from the 2017 FBI Uniform Crime Report. Do you see segregation affecting crime patterns in your city, in your town? What do you want to know about research into community violence or where crime happens? Join in at 800-642-1234. Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating crime patterns as part of a year-long project. So, Ashley, let's turn to Milwaukee's crime patterns today. How do more integrated neighborhoods compare to more segregated ones when it comes to crime?
Well, you can see, again, with my colleague Andrew Malika, you know, we were able to find that the 10 most integrated census tracts in the city of Milwaukee, and again, we say most integrated, that doesn't mean they're fully integrated, but of the census tracts in the city, the ones that are the 10 most integrated tend to have a lower poverty rate than the citywide average. They have lower shooting rates and lower homicide rates. And then what we also found was that when we looked at, we sort of replicated work of other researchers who studied Philadelphia. They were looking at how those redlining maps from the 30s created patterns. You know, if we looked at those same areas today, how do rates of violence compare to the citywide average? And just like what they found in Philadelphia, we also found that those areas had higher rates of homicides, poverty, and non-fatal shootings. And that's something that the researchers and that we are careful to note, you know, it doesn't necessarily prove causation, but typically when you have indicators and a correlation like that, it suggests it's worth looking at further.
Yeah, how strong is this correlation that you draw here between segregation and crime?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that I found while researching this piece was a relatively new study out of Boston University, and it was looking at how there's so in who is victimized by homicide, particularly gun homicide. And when we look at the rates of white firearm homicide versus black firearm homicide, those rates tend to be there tends to be a gap between those rates. The black firearm homicide rate in cities, like generally across the country, tends to be higher than the white firearm homicide rate. But when they looked at different cities, they found that it varied, that gap, so the space between those two rates by race, tends to vary widely depending on the city. And so, and in this particular case, I should zoom out. They were looking at statewide data, and they want to replicate it with the city. But they were looking at that, and they were wondering why, for example, in Wisconsin, is a black resident 22 times more likely to be fatally shot than a white resident? But if you're in New Mexico, that a black resident there would be twice as likely as a white resident to be fatally shot. Why is that gap twice as likely, 22 times as likely? Why is that so wide? And what they found, they did a lot of work analyzing and controlling for all the other factors we've talked about, you know, unemployment, poverty, incarceration, family structure, home ownership. And what they really found was the single greatest predictor of that wide gap was segregation. And so in their mind, that's just another way, if you're looking at violence sort of holistically as a public health issue and trying to address it on multiple fronts, that indicates to them that segregation is another risk factor, a public health risk factor for firearm violence.
But homicide rates and crime rates, they change year to year. So how do criminologists that look at segregation as one of these factors here when you see rates going up and down?
That's a really good point. And so that's why I would argue that, yes, so criminologists have typically focused on those more immediate factors, those risk factors that we think of, individual factors. Is a person engaged in what we would maybe consider risky behavior, you know, if that involves the sale of narcotics or carrying a gun or having some sort of gang affiliation? And even though those rates can fluctuate year to year, you know, in Milwaukee, we saw a huge spike from 2014 to 2015, as did other cities across the country. There were a lot of different theories for that. One, researchers now are suggesting the opioid crisis and the drug trade related to that played a role. But what you see over time is consistency in that gap and who is most likely to be victimized. And so by looking, that has stayed constant, even as the totals have fluctuated when we're talking about homicide and non-fatal shootings. And so I think because of that constancy, that's why people are looking at more systemic factors. You know, why do these gaps seem to remain?
We're looking at the role of segregation in crime patterns with Ashley Lutheran, and she covers public safety for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been investigating violence as part of a year-long fellowship at Marquette. You can join in. Do you see segregation affecting crime patterns in your own community? Some neighborhoods have less access to jobs and good schools or health care. Share your stories, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ashley, you also looked at the role of white flight, that is, white residents moving out of the city to the suburbs, something that we saw certainly during the 90s. How did white flight shape Milwaukee's neighborhoods today?
I think that's a factor that's often brought up. And in the work that I was doing for this particular piece, it was important to reference those sort of government interventions that facilitated that. And that could be anything from highway expansion or looking at where highways were built or where homes were torn down, you know, that period in the 90s, you know, known as urban renewal, and looking at that. And so that's sort of how you see such a stark pattern when it comes to the metropolitan segregation that currently exists in the Milwaukee area. And so you see those, you can almost see like the exact county dividing line when you're looking at population maps based on race. Looking at that, you see a real stark difference when you're going into other counties. And that doesn't mean any area is a monolith, of course. But when you're looking kind of holistically and in the aggregate, that's what you see. And so that's, you know, facilitated by other things and reinforced by, like I said, government investments or zoning laws, local zoning laws that maybe prohibit multifamily housing or other things like that. That's what housing policy experts would argue anyway.
And when we use the word crimes here, crimes is a real sweeping word. What types of crime did you study while looking at crime patterns and segregation?
So for this particular piece and this project, I'm focusing heavily on victimization. particularly when it comes to non-fatal shootings, people who are shot and survive their injuries, as well as all homicides, but paying close attention to firearm homicides, which on average make up anywhere from 80 to 85% of all homicides in the city of Milwaukee. And so that's what I focused on. And so that's why when you were asking earlier about different kinds of crime rates within integrated neighborhoods versus the citywide average, and then looking at those patterns set up through the redlined areas where they currently are now, that's why we, my colleagues and I, looked at those specific factors, non-fatal shootings and homicides.
You mentioned in your reporting that some experts call Milwaukee one of the worst places in the nation to raise a black family. Is that only because of its crime rates? Are there other issues at work here?
Oh, there are many other issues at work here. I think usually when experts have said that, they're looking at sort of the city as a whole. None of this has happening in isolation. And I think that's really important to remember. I think even when you were doing your call outs for having listeners to call in and share their experiences, you're asking them about, you know, educational opportunities as well as, you know, economic opportunities, job opportunities, food deserts. All of these things play into how healthy a city is and how well it helps support families, all families.
Sandy from Milwaukee called, and she couldn't stay with us. And she says she used to live in Wauwega, and there was no public transportation, and the only grocery store they had was temporarily closed. She thinks it is segregated there. Do you see all of Wisconsin having issues like this? Is this not isolated to Milwaukee?
I'm sure it's not. I think you see these patterns replicated in ways small and large across the country. I think it's more pronounced in Milwaukee and in other major cities. But I have no doubt that there are really other communities in Wisconsin that are also segregated. And they may not be segregated along racial lines, but along economic lines or along other, other differences. I have no doubt. And there's a question of, you know, how did it get that way? What are we going to do about it? And what is that currently influencing within the city and the place where you live?
Right. So what do you do about it? What is the talk in Milwaukee around these issues like redlining?
Well, I think there's a real desire, judging by my email inbox, to talk about solutions. And I agree. I know that some readers felt like, well, this story didn't tell me anything I couldn't already see, which I certainly respect. But I do think there is a push and a desire for more solutions. And some of those I've already mentioned here, but I think, you know, looking at your fair housing councils, looking at those organizations that are trying to break down barriers, you know, some of the work that my colleagues have done on landlords and evictions, you know, all of this sort of plays into equity, issues of equity, and are people getting equal opportunities to succeed and to live healthy, thriving lives? And so I think looking at issues of transit, looking at issues of housing, availability of housing, affordability of housing, that's all huge. How you're able to connect people to jobs. And I would also argue, again, the Fair Housing Council, it's really interesting because they work very hard to try to figure out what are the barriers, not just for, you know, discrimination based on race, but discrimination based off of if you're a family trying to live somewhere or if you have a disability trying to live somewhere. So I think that kind of work is also critical.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Luthern has been investigating crime patterns, looking at historical segregation. Still time for your observations about your community, your questions, 800-642-1234. What's lingering here on your mind? What do you want to say about segregation and crime in your own community? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the cycle of crime in Milwaukee and what segregation in the city has to do with it. You're with us for an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Milwaukee, as in similar cities, researchers say segregation is at the root of the disparity in homicides. In 2017, the 10 cities with the highest concentration of violent crime were also among America's most segregated. So what do you want to know about research into community violence and where crime happens? What do housing policies look like in your community? Do you live in a segregated community through your own eyes? Still time for your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Ashley Luthern has been investigating crime patterns as part of a year-long fellowship, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Rick joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Rick.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a question for you. My cousin's on the SWAT team with a dog down in Milwaukee for about 25 years. And he works basically in the hood. And what he tells me, and there is a lot of violence there. And it is, of course, very segregated. But what he's telling me is most of the guns they retrieve are illegally purchased. And I don't know if there's some kind of a correlation between the segregations, whether there's more illegal firearms or legal firearms between the white population and the African-American population.
Rick, thank you so much for the question. Ashley, what do we know there?
I think that's a really interesting point. And your friend, I'm sure, you know, is right. You know, in the cases that I write about, frequently people who are charged with committing shooting crimes, frequently they often are legally prohibited from having a gun anyway. So I know that's a huge topic of discussion here in Milwaukee and across the nation, is how to make sure that people who are legally prohibited from having a firearm are able to access one. And I think there's been an ongoing conversation and concern at the public policy level and at the police department level that actually kind of leads into some of the work I'm exploring next in this series, which is what people in Milwaukee have been doing over the past 18 months to really address gun violence. And so I'll be looking at what the police department has been doing under the tenure of Chief Alfonso Morales. They're having weekly shoot reviews. And as part of that, they certainly are looking at the firearms involved and the individuals involved, who is a suspect, who is a victim, and trying to really pinpoint who is most at risk for being victimized and trying to address those kinds of crime problems. So that will be explored in a further story. And as part of that, they certainly are working with other law enforcement agencies to try to figure out where these firearms are coming from.
Rick, thanks so much. Let's go to Orville now in Madison. Hi, Orville.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk. I would want to suggest to your researcher that she'll get better data if she doesn't use white as a race. That these cities are dominated by certain ethnic groups. Milwaukee by the Germans, Chicago by Irish, New York by Jews, and the people in the Southwest, you should use white for the Southwest. There's a lot of Mexicans and Hispanic Americans there. If she looks at the different hostility between the white ethnic groups and the blacks, she'll get better data. Also,
okay, and Orville, I want Ashley to respond to that as you break down various ethnicities. What do you see there with patterns?
So what we typically are using is census data. So we are a little hampered by that, I would suppose. So census data does does not break down different ethnicities the way Orville is suggesting. The ethnicity that they do track is Hispanic. So, it's typically listed in census data as like white ethnicity Hispanic. And so that I think in that respect, we are a little bit limited in that sort of way, because we predominantly are using census data for a lot of this work.
Paul from Eau Claire emailed to ask, so what do we do about this? What is it for me, my family, to live in an integrated neighborhood if we know we see increased crime and lower community trust in those areas?
So he's asking what his family should do, or
yeah,
about
so,
their own?
Right. So what should you do if you are seeing a neighborhood that is, maybe not as integrated and you want your family to feel secure and not have crime in the neighborhood, how do you establish more trust? And what are the, you know, how do you promote more integration?
So I think one of the key things is always, it sounds very simple, but I hear this over and over again from people in every community that are who are worried about safety. It's really, you know, getting to know your neighbors, talking to your neighbors, and then, you know, getting engaged with different community events. And I think it's really important to remember that although, you know, when there's discussion of crime patterns, you know, neighborhoods get stigmatized. I know that we hear this as reporters all the time. You know, neighborhoods get stigmatized. And really, when you look at the work, for example, I'll refer back to the shooting reviews that the police department is currently doing and the research that criminologists have done, is that it's a very small percentage of people who are actually causing crime-related problems in different neighborhoods. They sort of have this outsized effect. And so it's really important to remember that everyone living in these neighborhoods is not, they're not a criminal, and we shouldn't think of it that way at all. And so in my mind, what everyone could do just on a personal level is, you know, make sure you know your neighbors, you know, get involved with your neighborhood associations, your community groups, and also citywide groups. You know, there are many interfaith groups. There are other groups if you like comic books, if you like other forms of art or entertainment, you can gather in those groups, and you're just meeting different kinds of people and you're forging new connections. And I think that's how, you know, getting to know different kinds of people is the best way on a personal level that I think we can all sort of combat this segregated society that we're navigating.
Let's bring in Maureen now in Mineral Point with thoughts on this. Hi, Maureen.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of years ago, I worked as a caregiver, took a break from my professional job, and I made the assumption that healthcare was a really big concern for workers because you had to work there a year before you could get insurance. But as I worked there longer, I found that there were even more basic needs like driver's license and that kind of thing. And I'm curious how much of this research, particularly with cause and effect, were there any interviews of people in these neighborhoods, or was this only data-driven?
Maureen, thanks. Ashley?
Thanks, Maureen. I certainly talked to a lot of people living in segregated neighborhoods for this work, and those barriers that you describe are incredibly real. You know, if someone doesn't have access to a driver's license, or maybe, you know, they paid a ticket but their license was suspended and they're not sure how to get that, you know, if someone's looking for food distribution or opportunities for the kids to play in a safe space, you know, those are all real barriers. Like you said, it's not just about having health care or some of these other needs that we often talk about. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind. And I think, again, in future stories, I'm currently working on a piece that's I'm sort of shadowing people who are doing just that, trying to reach out to people who have been victimized by violence and making sure those most immediate needs are met. You know, if they want to move, then they're helping them move. If they want to, you know, if they need a job, they're helping connecting them to resources, because that's the thing. There often are resources, especially in a city the size of Milwaukee, but it's a matter of connecting the people who need those resources to them. There's sort of, sometimes there's this gulf in access and accessibility. And so I'm actually shadowing the 414 Life team through the city's Office of Violence Prevention, and that's a lot of the work that they're doing, as well as the Alma Center and a lot of the work they're doing with individuals who have been victimized and trying to, you know, I just had an interview yesterday with someone who was explaining to me, yes, I'm, you know, trying to get my disability because I was injured by a firearm, I was injured in a shooting, and I can't work anymore, at least temporarily. But in the meantime, I'm also doing some job training as I can at a desk so that I'm prepared when I can go back to work. And then, you know, I'm trying to make sure I know exactly what resources are available for housing. And so that was an individual who's helped by the Alma Center.
Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ashley Lutheran covers public safety and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been investigating crime patterns for an O'Brien Fellowship in Public Service Journalism at Marquette. She joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. Just ahead, it's On Point, talking about the global economy and the fear of a possible recession. Is this the summer of fear? That's just ahead on Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.